Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very happy to have as my guest for the second time Colm McCann, whose new novel, Zonli, has recently been published by Random House. He's the author, as well, of Fishing the Slow Black River, Song Dogs, This Side of Brightness, Everything in This Country Must, and Dancer. Now, this book is a book based upon the life of a gypsy poet.
That's right.
Now, tell me how you chose the subject.
Well, that's funny. I wonder, do we choose subjects, or do subjects choose us? I mean, sometimes I wonder. This subject sort of clamped onto me after I'd finished writing Dancer, which was a fictionalization of the life of Rudolf Nureyev. And it was sort of a big, expansive novel that went in a number of different places. And I really wanted to go home and get quiet and write one of those novels that I could sort of take care of and not have to research and not have to read around or anything like that. But my wife was reading Isabel Fonseca's book, Bury Me Standing, which was an examination of the life of the Romani people in Europe, primarily in the 20th century. And there's this extraordinary photograph right at the front of the book of Papushka, whose real name means doll in Polish. And she was a poet, one of the most famous Romani poets, and who had been exiled from her own people because she had first formed a bridge between her people, the gypsies, as we sort of pejoratively call them now, and the socialist government. But it was a really interesting time because the socialists had come into power. They looked at the gypsy population of Poland and they said, well, these people have been kicked around. They've been burnt out. They've been sterilized. They've been, abused for centuries. You know, every political system has done this to them. Now, we can go in and prove the value of our system by embracing them and having a sort of black is beautiful movement from within the government. And so there was like all sorts of things that went on in Poland at the time. Airplanes would go out and drop these leaflets down over the roads. Citizens of gypsy origin, you know, come join us, as if they were their sort of the ultimate proletariat. And then they found Papushka and her songs and transcribed her songs. But you know who did it? It was Jerzy Witkowski, who later found Bruno Schulz, who, as you know, wrote Street of Crocodiles, as one of the great Jewish writers of Poland, of anywhere. And he found Papushka and started publishing her poetry, but it was her doom. Because while one hand was celebrating, we know this in politics all the time, while one hand was celebrating the gypsies and trying to say, you know, they're valuable to our culture, the other hand decided that they would assimilate them. And that meant bringing them in off the roads, chopping the wheels off their wagons, burning the wheels, requisitioning the horses for collective farms. And as we always do, we sort of kill our prophets, don't we? And so the gypsies looked at Papushka and said, well, it's her fault. Because she made this link with the, you know, she became the poster girl for socialism. And, so I'd found that story. And much as I tried to get rid of it, she sort of sat on my shoulder for a long, long, long time. And I kept trying to walk away from her, but she kept coming back to me. And so I fictionalized it, and Zonli came out of that.
The previous novel, Dancer, which, as you say, is inspired by the life of Nureyev, was very much a book about the people who surround the artists, the
right.
Peasant upbringing, the man who made his shoes, the stagehands. This is a book about an artist caught between worlds.
Right.
Eventually, her own world will exile her,
right.
Essentially put a curse on her, say that she is a polluter,
right.
And her name will no longer be mentioned.
Exactly.
She is an exile of exiles.
Absolutely.
She's sent on the road by people who stay on the road. And she is also, in a sense, betrayed by the Czechoslovakian government, who, having used her music, her poetry, to create these socialist posters inviting the gypsies to come live in government-subsidized projects, which the gypsies don't want to live in,
right.
They essentially prepare the stage for her exile from her people.
Absolutely.
So she is an artist between cultures, much as Nureyev was an artist in the thick of cultures in
right.
the previous book. And I wondered about that sense of the creation of an artist. You do it in the novel with this figure Zsolnai, much as Vygotsky creates Papushka. She's seen to be manipulated, really,
right.
by people who, with all the goodwill in the world, are entrepreneurs of the gypsy poet.
That's right. And I think you've put your finger on the pulse, absolutely. I think it's a book about the human heart in conflict with power, you know, and power structures. And what happens to our, you know, our passions, our loves, our beauties? What happens to them when they come slap back up against systems that are in place that need certain logic, and the logic of poetry won't apply to that. And so so Zsolnai, much as she sort of becomes the poster girl for the government, is sort of taken down by the government. So it becomes a book about language and how that language can get taken away from us, and how the power can corrupt even something as simple as, you know, or as complicated as falling in love. There's an English expatriate, Stephen Swan, who falls in love with Zsolnai, and he believes that he wants to elevate her, that he will use her language and her poems to bring a new enlightenment into this socialist society. In the end, he prints her poems because he's scared too. And I actually use, there's a Czechoslovakian poet called Stransky in the novel who actually gets shot by the people, the very people he's been involved with. But I use this old Irish story about Erskine Childers in 1916, when Erskine Childers was lined up in front of the British firing squad. He gave the perfect retort to them when they asked if he had anything to say. He said, "Come closer, it'll be easier for you."
Well, he becomes a problematic figure as well, because Zsolnai does not see herself as a poet at all. He is a poet, and he spends a good deal of time tampering with her line breaks.
That's right.
These are poems by transcription. They're recorded on the microphone, and, you know, he experiments with rhythms and line breaks for her. If she is a poet, he's taught her.
That's right.
This is not within her traditions. Her grandfather has taught her to read, but it is not the case that Romani women were taught to read.
Exactly.
In fact, among her people, still she has to hide the fact that she reads. Stransky wants her to carry a book with her, or maybe
right.
it's his assistant Swan,
yeah.
so that she can break the image of the bookless gypsy woman.
Right.
And so much is about the way in which she is turned into an icon for something that will eventually dispossess her,
right.
leave her trebly homeless.
Exactly. And that was one of the difficult things for me to get at. You know, I'll be honest with you here. This was the most difficult book for me to research and examine. First of all, because you know there's very little, you know, really proper scholarship that has gone on down through the years. There has been all sorts of repetitions of things that weren't true. For example, the great Romney scholar who's down at the University of Texas, Ian Hancock, has traced. There's a notion abroad in the world that there's no words in the Gypsy language for truth, right? For beauty, for duty, or for possession. Including numerous other words. This came about because in the early 19th century, an anthropologist had gone in and sort of looked at the Romani population and decided that he was going to write this. But then it was repeated endlessly down through the years, even by serious scholars. But because they weren't Romani, they had no access to the what was truly going on in the language, and Hancock, who's a British-born Rom, debunks this myth so quickly and so swiftly by showing numerous words in the language for truth, beauty, possession, duty, and other things. But it sort of plays into our idea of the Gypsy. Oh, there's no truth, you know. There's no duty, you know. So in many ways, what happens to Zoli is that she becomes the conduit of other people's mistakes.
And the voice of their voices.
Exactly.
Their belief that a person can be the voice of a culture. They turn her into that, and eventually she becomes that again and again.
Right.
When she is eventually in a displaced person's camp, she's told, you can do anything, you can go to town, mm-hmm. but don't start telling fortunes.
Right.
But it's the only way that she can get some money, and she right. becomes other people's idea of a Gypsy.
She becomes the original Gypsy, and she knows what a massive irony this is for herself, because here she is, this woman who's like concerned with issues of memory, concerns of issues of forgetting, and how do we get our story across, and suddenly everything is taken from her. It's a social death, and once she gets to the great mythical West, you know, and she breaks the border into the West, she's put into a camp for displaced people. And there, the only way that she can get by is sort of by becoming the sort of chicken stealing, you know, fortune telling gypsy that makes us comfortable, that makes us on the outside sort of comfortable.
Well, her every pretense is meaningful to this fiction, because first she pretends she can't speak, and indeed she has no voice of her own. It's true that she can't speak. Her voice has been imposed upon her.
Right.
And then later in the book, in an astonishing sequence, she's telling a fortune, and the person who is the first to ask to have his palm read so believes in his idea of what a gypsy does and the vastness of gypsies' prescient powers, he tells her his future, and she repeats it to him.
Yes.
So that once again, in this book, it's like someone who's been given the poem to recite and then is called a poet, a
right.
fortune teller. Does art, this is what the book asked me, does art have a home?
Oh, that's an extraordinary question. And I think it's one that Zoli tears apart, rips apart, and then looks at in the end. I hope I don't give away too much by saying that she sort of returns. She goes to Paris at the end, where there's a grand sort of conference on the Romani people, and her daughter is in a situation where her daughter would love for her to get up and stand up and to either sing a poem or sing a song or speak to the assembled people, and Zoli says no. But she finds art, she finds the home of art in that small, tiny, almost insignificant gesture, that passing gesture, when she sings, laid on in a quiet place that where it seemingly doesn't matter. But I mean, it's an enormous question. It's an enormous question.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Colm McCann, author most recently of Zolli, published by Random House. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Colm McCann about his novel, Zolli. I think it's no accident that you wrote this novel after moving to New York. And that as someone who has been winning recognition and prizes as an Irish writer, writing a novel about a Russian dancer, the next question becomes writing about a woman who belongs to a tradition of homelessness, of calling no place her home.
Right.
And I wondered whether one's sense of having to travel the world and ransack cultures to find prototypes for oneself. How does one become an artist? You say in your acknowledgement that we learn from the voices of others.
Right.
But it's also one senses that one cannot stay home and be an artist. James Joyce tells his parents, after they've all seen an Ibsen play, what you've seen on that stage will be happening in our house very shortly. You have to leave home.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, Joyce said in a letter to Frank Bludgeon, he said, I've been so long out of Ireland that I can all at once hear her voice in every place and everything. And I think I'm concerned with issues of home, because nearly all of my characters are away from home, and they're trying to find a way back home. But it's never back to that actual physical home of where they came from. It's more a spiritual home in which they can find some sense of what they've created and some sense of joy at the end. Because I'm really interested in this notion, that a very, very simple notion that's complex at its heart, that that we're all finally searching for some moment of joy when it all makes sense. I will say this, that when I was in the subway tunnels of New York with the homeless people, and I talked to them, no matter how mad they were, no matter how poor they were, no matter how sad they were, no matter what sort of situation they were living in, they would always say to me, when I get out of here, not if I get out of here, but when I get out of here, there's always a constant search for that home. And I have, gone away, and maybe I'm searching for home. But the home that I want to find is that empathetic home. I believe there's a sort of political thing going on whereby we as fiction writers must learn to say that empathy and making that shotgun metaphorical leap into that other person's skin, trying to understand that is so important right now, when we've devalued grief in so many ways. Our leaders don't talk about grief. They don't seem to have any way to try to understand what the other is, and particularly the kicked down, stamped down other. I'm middle class, white, Irish, suburban. I was raised in these ways, but I'm interested in that sort of that moment of recklessness that brings me into, another skin that says, finally, at least discovers a way home.
At the beginning of the book, Zoli's first memory is essentially she's watching her whole culture sink underwater.
Right.
If you can tell the story, she's with her grandfather, I believe.
Yeah, it's based on a true story, and it's really horrific. The Slovak Hlinka guards, which were the equivalent of the Gestapo, they ring the lake, a frozen lake, with fires and soldiers, and they shove the gypsy, the whole compania, out onto the centre of the lake, and they wait for spring to come in order for the ice to break. And what happens is the horses fall, the wagons fall, the children fall, the adults fall. But Zoli and her grandfather actually escape.
Zoli then has a lake, now in memory.
That's right.
Filled with her past. The wagons have sunk. Her parents, her sister, all of the company.
Right.
This is something she's seen as a child.
Right.
The sinking under the water. And it's what she draws upon when she sings.
That's right.
So that to an extent, art, even for the gypsy she comes to travel with as a young woman,
right.
Art is about the lost thing, the missing thing, the thing that no one knows anymore. It
right.
isn't available to be articulated. And so
right.
watching Zoli's track through this novel is like watching your own.
Mm.
You're drawing from a pool not just of Zoli's images, but your own images.
Right.
And it's, in that sense, a collaboration as well.
Yeah, I believe so. And I would, you know, I would say that Zoli's poem, the one that finally enters the book, even though it has manners on it that had been put down by Stransky, the title of the poem is But by the bones they broke, we can tell new weather. And what she's saying in that, by looking at what they have done to us, by looking at whatever we have created, we can possibly tell something new. And you know what's amazing to me is that you know, we launched this book last week in New York, and actually the Gypsy Kings came along and played, and we had a great night. And but we had a number of Romani people in the audience who came up to me afterwards, and they said, you know, it's been a long time since we've had a Romani gathering, and you know, to have a book like this, they said it feels like, you know, I can take this to people now and say, you know, have this book, read this book, and then I can tell them that I'm Romani, without any fear of them thinking that it'll be all about jangling bracelets or brutalization, or that I'm going to rob and steal and cheat and lie. And nothing felt better to me than that somebody would say that they could carry this book now and finally say, hey, you know, I'm a banker or I'm an insurance clerk, but I'm Romani too. And it's extraordinary to me that in the early part of the 21st century, that people are still scared to identify who they are. And I think Zoli was looking at that and trying to find a way for herself, even though she gets exiled from her own people.
I was realizing that this is, in fact, as you were saying, a time when people are recognizing that it's necessary to make an attempt to write in a different voice.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Eggers is writing in the voice of one of the Sudanese lost boys. Norman Mailer's newest book is in the voice of an SS guard.
Right.
We're finding more and more the recognition that we have to drop the border of the self and allow a different voice to come through us, because if all we know is ourselves,
right.
then we're, as writers, creatures of limited knowledge.
This is radical, and it's political, and it's absolutely necessary, because we are living in an age when the facts were put down in front of us. You know, Colin Powell went on television and said, this is a photograph. It is a fact. It is a photograph of a tanker. Therefore, it's a chemical tanker. Therefore, it's a tanker, you know, it's weapons of mass destruction. And isn't it amazing how the facts get manipulated? Because facts are mercenary bastards, you know. They can be packed up, shipped off to whatever little orphanage we want them to go to. We can manipulate facts in extraordinary ways. And they've been sending our children to war. They've been doing all sorts of things. And I think the writer, the Dave Eggers of the world, the Ondaatjes of the world, you know, what they're doing right now is they're saying, consciously or unconsciously, I don't know, hold on a minute. Hold on a minute. Let's, you know, take these sort of supposed factual lives and let's, you know, reinvigorate them with, you know, as Berger says, never again will a single story be told as if it were the only one. Let's change them. And then also, even just as radical, if not more radical, let's inhabit an altogether different skin, a Sudanese skin or a Russian skin or a Romani skin or whatever it happens to be, and say, this story is valuable. This story is ours. This is part of our makeup and our DNA. And if we realize that, if we understand that on its deepest, most human level, then I think we can become better.
I've been speaking with Colm McCann, author most recently of Zolli, published by Random House. Thank you, Colm, for joining me.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt from Zolli on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.